Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAA LP 107.3 FM Albany, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Kaylin.
And I'm Sina. Tonight, Mark Dunley reports on a recent report that was put out by BOCES. Anita Murphy and Dr. Aaron Boschniak tell us about that report.
Then Willie Terry brings us a new debate called Lessons Learned from the Civil Rights Movement to the Black Lives Matter Movement.
Later on, we have this week's Triple E segment. H. Botch Jr. interviews me about my new role as the HMM's multimedia producer and other work that I've done.
After that, Mark Dunley speaks with Anita Stanley about the militarization of the police.
Finally, Steve Pierce interviews Rebecca Watts, Regional Vice President of Western Governors University, about the learning model of that university. But first, some headlines.
Starting in April, arts, entertainment, and event venues can reopen at 33% capacity with a limit of 100 people indoors or 200 people outdoors, and a requirement that all attendees wear masks and be socially distant. Those limits would be increased to 150 people indoors or 500 people outdoors if all attendees test negative before entering. Gatherings of 100 people indoors and 200 people outdoors will also be allowed.
New York will also relax implemented travel restrictions on domestic visitors who have been vaccinated within 90 days of their second inoculation. International travelers will have to quarantine for 10 days.
The federal mass vaccination site at Albany Armory has opened and will seek to vaccinate 7,000 people a week. The site focuses on reaching people of color. The shots are intended for Capital Region residents living in certain urban zip codes.
City Democrats have declined to endorse the leaders of the Rensselaer County Legislature Democratic minority. Minority Leader Peter Grimm and Deputy Minority Leader Cindy Doran led the unsuccessful effort to get the county's legislators to support the Black Lives Matter movement. Grimm and Doran are expected to launch a primary challenge.
The City of Schenectady Police released a series of reforms this week, including a proposal to create a specialized team that would respond to reports of people in mental health crisis. Community engagement officers trained in harm reduction and community health will also fan out in the city's neighborhoods and connect people with professional counselors. Some of the members of city's police reform panels suggest that funding for such efforts should be transferred from city police officers to social service agencies. The Capital District BOCES recently completed a report about the Schenectady City School District at the request of the district. The report focuses on school employees who cited concerns remaking a priority of academics and overcoming a culture of distrust. We hear from Anita Murphy, District Superintendent of BOCES, and Dr. Aaron Boninick, Interim Superintendent of the School District.
Today we're going to cover a recent report that BOCES had put out at the request of the Schenectady City School District, particularly talking to a lot of the employees of the City School District about possible reforms. We'll be hearing from Anita Murphy, who is a director, district superintendent for BOCES, and Dr. Aaron Boschniak, who is the, interim superintendent for the Schenectady School District. So Anita, what prompted the study to be done?
So the administration and the Board of Education approached BOCES about looking at their internal systems, everything from operations to curriculum and instruction, and commissioned a report as they were searching for a new superintendent and having a former superintendent leave. I think it's always a good time to take a self-reflective look. I am incredibly proud of the district, the board, and the administration for doing this. Sometimes it's hard to take a look at yourself and say, you know, what do we need to change? But the board and the administration have been incredibly helpful to us in doing this report. I'd also like to say that the staff members that Shannon Tahoe and our other colleagues at BOCES talked to were incredibly forthcoming and honest about what they thought needed to be reformed in the district. And we appreciate everybody's cooperation in this report.
Now, you know, looking at the, you know, summary of key findings, a couple of things that sort of stand out, and you primarily interviewed apparently 150, you know, schools, staff people. They did express some concern. There was not, in their opinion, I guess, enough priority in academics, some concerns about curriculum, and a little bit concern about a culture of mistrust and need perhaps some clearer definition of roles and responsibility in certain areas of the organization. You know, so what were some of the key recommendations in terms of trying to address some of these findings?
Well, let me start with the curriculum. I think that one is stands out pretty sharply. You know, the state passed new standards and an implementation timeline about 4 years ago. They should have been at full implementation, but because of the pandemic, it's been pushed a little bit. Districts across the state have been working on these new standards. So Schenectady has done some work on the standards, but having a coherent, cohesive curriculum that goes with these standards that I would say is teacher generated is going to be critically important to getting this done so that the children in Schenectady have what they need to enter the world and be ready for the next level. We are firm believers that we teach how to do this, and then we allow teachers they do best, and that is write relevant curriculum and use relevant instructional materials with the students that they know best, that they have and know best.
Now, I know since I read the Daily Gazette every morning that Schenectady's had, unfortunately, a lot of layoffs with respect to, you know, the COVID, I believe maybe close to 400 or so. You know, maybe this is a question for Dr. Bosniak. You know, how has the board, you know, reacted to the report and what steps are, you know, they, you know, considering in response?
So the board has certainly responded to the report. The findings in the report, I think they're favorable to the findings, and they're looking at those recommendations very seriously and wanting to develop a responsive action plan. And I think the whole notion of the report was done under the guise of wanting to improve. They knew that there were some areas that we were deficient or areas where there were gaps that we needed to focus on more intensively. This is really providing us the opportunity to create the roadmap to be able to do that. So their response to it, I think, is certainly one that's positive because it gives us that framework to operate within and an area to focus on. So it's exactly what they were hoping for.
So what will the, you know, next steps be in terms of, you know, following up on some of the recommendations? And also, you know, how, you know, can parents and even students, you know, provide some input if changes are to be made?
So the district will be hosting several town hall style meetings regarding this report and our next steps. We want to make sure that the action plans that we create are being done with the people that it affects the most. So any time a decision is being made, that decision-making process really needs to include the people who are affected and impacted by the decision. So our next steps will be having, starting next week, some town hall sessions with both internal and external stakeholders, including parents.
How has the teachers union had any response so far to the report?
They've been included along the way, certainly in the creation of the report. I haven't had my regular standing meeting with them just yet to talk about that, but I certainly plan on that being a point of conversation with them and would want to invite them to be partners at the table in the creation of the action plan to respond to the recommendations from the BOCES report.
So maybe this is, you know, a question for Anita, but was there anything, you know, particularly, you know, surprising, you know, from your study, both sort of positive and negative? And is there anything that, you know, you all particularly learned that you hadn't expected going in?
I don't think it was anything unexpected. I think we see this in a lot of school districts that are in transition. So let me talk about the most positive thing, I think, in the report. The most positive thing is there are incredibly committed people in Schenectady to not only the community, but to the children in Schenectady. And that's a positive. That's, you're 90% of the way there to fixing issues when you have people who are committed to doing so. And we found that people are incredibly committed to the children and the community of Schenectady. I think the thing that we would stress is on our findings is the communication and the way that people communicate is going to be the key in making sure that the reforms are done and stick. I know Aaron's implemented a lot of those things already, but you know, something as simple as creating an internal intranet that's just, you know, for the folks in the district where they can go and find every single thing that they need or all the communications that are there is going to be incredibly powerful in helping them to fix some of the things around communication. And I think that goes to the culture question that you asked previously. A lot of that is just communication so that people know what they're supposed to know and are empowered to make decisions based on those things.
Schenectady, both the school district and unfortunately the city, does have a very significant rate of poverty, especially poverty among children. How does sort of poverty impact upon the overall school environment for the student?
So I would say from my perspective, you know, an urban school district, an urban school system is a really complex system to navigate. And it's because poverty is one of those factors that we have to contend with. So at the local level, we're constantly working to be able to overcome some of the barriers that students present with and try to minimize those to the greatest extent possible so that we can focus on academics. And it's more than just poverty. Of course, it's trauma and the other social emotional supports that students need as they come to school each day. It's part of the work that we do and that our educators do on a daily basis to minimize those barriers so that students can be ready and able to learn.
And Mark, I think it's important to note that in lots of communities with poverty, people are doing the things that Aaron is talking about, you know, mitigating the factors that poverty brings. But I do want to say that there always is and always has to be a culture of expectation for children that we want them to be ready to go in the world. And so in places like Schenectady, the mitigation of those factors is done on behalf of the children today, but on behalf of the children into the future so that those factors don't impact our graduates when they leave us in being able to get good jobs and go to college or the trades or whatever they decide to do.
We're out of time, unfortunately. We've been talking with Anita Murphy, different superintendent for BOCES, and Dr. Aaron Bosniak, interim superintendent for the Schenectady School District. If people want to read this report, what's the easiest way to do that?
So the report is posted on the Schenectady City School District's homepage. So if you go to our website, it's right on the homepage. There's a link directly to the report and an executive summary.
Thank you very much. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Including affected people as decision makers is generally a good idea. What do you think?
Yeah.
And we hope to hear more about groups that pay attention to that. Thank you, Mark Dunley, for bringing out that report with Anita Murphy and Dr. Aaron Bosniak.
WOOC roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry started another new segment entitled The Struggle Continues. He defines it as the roundtable discussion on topics that impact freedom struggles. The subject of today's debate is lessons learned from the civil rights movement to the Black Lives Matter movement. The panelist for this discussion is Dave Walker, Leon Van Dyke, Carlo Duffler, and Angel Martinez. This is part one of a seven-part series.
This is Willie Terry, your roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Network. Tonight you will hear second installment of my new roundtable discussion entitled The Struggle Continues. And you will hear the first of several segments. I have as my regular panel to discuss issues Leon Van Dyke, who is an activist and a member of the Brothers, Dave Walker, an activist, labor leader, and teacher, Carlos Dolfer, who is an activist and was involved in the civil rights movement and the Poor People Campaign, and Angel Martinez, who is an activist and also involved in the Poor People Campaign today. Now, today's discussion topic is lessons learned from the civil rights movement to the Black Lives Matter movement. We have a good panel who has many years being involved in the struggle, and they are still active today. Now, the discussion has already begun, so let's chime in.
It's a powerful brief that he took off some time from his activities on the NAACP and wrote during the 30s. So I would say that was the first major step in our struggle.
Now, I just want to clarify something. You're talking about that movement came during Reconstruction?
The chronology is that Douglass insisted, while the Union was losing, that black troops would make the difference. And you had the black troops enlisting in the army and making a difference in the Civil War. It was our troops that were making a difference in the Civil War. So after the Civil War, all these things were enacted to all our rights were supposed to be enacted. Citizenship, the right to vote, this and that. And that led to the first time for black legislators taking over in many states in the South. And then there was the Hayes-Tilden Compromise where the sellout was, and the South went back to being a segregationist center. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that Du Bois wrote the great piece in the mid-30s called Black Reconstruction, and he spells out exactly what happened during that period. So that was the first period.
Okay.
Blacks played a key role in the Spanish-American War. They saved Teddy Roosevelt, San Juan Hill. I mean, so blacks have been struggling and World War One and onward. So, but that should be the part of the chronology of how we participated in the American struggle for justice, so-called struggle for justice. Okay.
So what about you, Leon?
I'd like to jump on what Dave was saying. And the contributions that we made are so many to this country and it's forgotten. And certainly the Civil War, the example that Dave gave, the Civil War and our contributions, we probably would not have a United States of America if it wasn't for those 300,000 black soldiers who fought in the Civil War, taking the place of many other white Americans who were deserting by large numbers. At the very least, that contribution made it possible for us to get an unconditional surrender from the South at that time. Right. But there were a number of other contributions I like to point out, because it's not covered too much in our history books, and that's the role of blacks who fought in the American Revolutionary War, and not just blacks on the side of the rebels, so to speak, but more blacks fought in the American Civil War on the side of the British, because the British issued a proclamation that any slave, and this is called the Dunmore Proclamation, any slave who helped to join to put down the rebels would be British citizens. Now, we don't know too much about that history because it's not talked about. But in England, they have what they call a black loyalist study. In Canada, they have Black Loyalist Day commemorating the contributions that those blacks made. So I would say that is significant in many, many ways. Most slaves and free men were sympathetic to the British as opposed to the Americans during that time. I know that's not commonly talked about, but it was true, and it's like dozens of books written about it, not so much by Americans. There's a three or four American authors who talked about this. So I would say Black Loyalists was one. And another period, and I would dare to say, I certainly would lump in what Danny said, that the contribution that we made by Blacks in the American Civil War. But the other thing is the apartheid system that alluded that the South built starting after the Great Compromise, 1887, and they built a segregated system that we, in the 60s, along with Dave and many, many other who I call heroes and sheroes, changed with that civil rights movement. Another period, at the risk of time, I would point out is that we had in the 1840s, we had a national black conference every year by abolitionists. And the first conference was in Albany. Frederick Douglass participated in a whole bunch of you. And it was the black abolitionists that was the foundation of the abolitionist movement. So I would say those, there were too many. I mean, there's so many, but I just point out to for the sake of time.
Oh, okay. Well, we have Carlos and Angel on the phone. How y'all doing?
Hey, all right.
We're doing all right, man.
All right.
I'm listening to what he said.
All right, yeah. And Carlos is an activist. He's was involved in the civil rights movement, and also he's involved in the Poor People Campaign. And Angel Martinez is an activist, and he's involved in the Poor People Campaign. Carlos and Angel, we're at that first question that we're dealing with. We're talking about what was some of the major movements in black history.
I think one of the main movements was, it was the time of the abolitionists. Martin Delaney was in Pittsburgh, people in Boston, that he wrote that newspaper that still exists. I can't remember it right now. It might be The Guardian. And he wrote this. So I think that one of the keys was it was always fighting for the very contributions of what people gave, of being made money of, is not treated as a human being, and that little constitution that they claim it is, two-fifths of a man, that it takes two to make one white person. I think one of the keys to the question was it was always the struggle, the contributions of Harriet Tubman, that many of them, she said, I remember she used to carry a pistol, and many of them didn't even know that they were slaves. They believed the narrative of what they were told, even to this day. It's almost similar. So from the very contributions of those people, like he said, who were the Black Empire loyalists that went over to Nova Scotia, that went over to New Brunswick and to Ontario, they played a part, but they were also betrayed by the British because they never really gave them, it was still rape with segregation and gave them the worstest land when they settled in New Brunswick and in Nova Scotia. But the key to the question was is that everybody was always struggling for the basic rights of fighting for human rights, to be treated as a human being. Many people participated in what they called the American Revolution, which was basically a revolution of white slave masters who ruled, who didn't think of nobody as a human being if you didn't have a piece of property. And it was mostly the white slave masters who made their money, filthy rich from slavery. Mm-hmm. So this is that. So it all boils down from the Civil War that people died, many people who were still slaves, and then they finally, if they got themselves together from the Underground Railroad that ran from all over the country, from New York, all over from New Jersey, all over the country, that fought for the very decency of being a human being. I think that one of the keys to the question has always been the fight for human rights.
Right.
All this other make-believe thing comes out of people who don't have intentions for us.
Right.
To say, you know, they always have to say civil rights. How could it be civil rights when when it deals with the very essence of a human being, allowed to vote, and he's a citizen, and he's denied the very aspects of being a human being, very denied a very essence of having a job to support his family.
You just heard panelists David Walker, Leon Van Dyke, Angel Martinez, and Carlo Duffler. In this debate is called Lessons Learned from the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Lives Matter Movement, created by our very own roaming labor correspondent, Willie Terry.
Triple E's host H. Bosch Jr. speaks with HMM Magazine's multimedia host, producer and my co-host for tonight, Sina Basila-Hickey. Sina is also a community-engaged visual artist, activist, educator with a background in documentary storytelling, pedagogy, and grassroots organizing. Sina was born in Basel, Switzerland, but lived most of her childhood in upstate New York. This is part one of a two-part segment.
Hello again, everyone. This is H. Bosch Jr.'s Triple E's Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. Today's guest is Sina Hickey, photographer, film producer, artist, entrepreneur. Her current position is station manager at WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. Sina is also born in Switzerland. This is part one of a two-part segment. Welcome to the show, Sina.
Glad to be here. So good to talk to you.
Yes, yes. And it's so good to talk with you. So I want to lead in with this question. Explain and describe what a community engaged visual artist is.
Well, for me, I think the community is the most important part in my work. And I try to make everything that I do accessible to different people. And I come from a teaching family, so passing on what I know to the people around me is something that I find really important and also gives me a lot of joy. So, I was an intern at the Sanctuary 10 years ago, and here I really developed that concept of, to use Steve's term, media activist. And so for me, the work that I do is very much in the intersection of using usually visual arts, but also audio to create a better community for me, the people around me, and even outside of my community.
Okay. So let's discuss refashion garbage. What is refashion garbage? You described it as an art practice with working with discarded material.
Yes. So I have been fascinated by the things that we throw out, the thing, what we find is valuable, and the things that we deem one use. And so the practice of refashion garbage was looking at the things that we discard differently. And so there's also a teaching element to that. And I make wearable designs out of it. So the viewers are often puzzled by what's going on. Are she really wearing plastic bags or aluminum foil? And the purpose of it is really to make somebody rethink the plastic wrapper that we put in the garbage without really even registering to the straws that we're using, to that when we use these things that are disposable, quote unquote, that we actually are registering what's going on. And I think that then creates a more thoughtful engagement with everything that we're using.
Okay. What was the creativity behind refashion garbage?
The creativity, I think, is trying to problem solve. Like, how do you make a plastic bag look aesthetic? So I would use techniques like braiding or knotting or weaving. For me, the aesthetic is a very big part of it. So it was, you know, I think once you learn anything, you start to navigate the world differently. And so it was so fun to kind of just think about, like, well, how can I use a straw or paper bag? Like, what are the different ways that it bends, moves? Most of the work that I did is ephemeral. Like, that wasn't the purpose of my work. But to kind of, challenge, to look at the material differently.
So Let's discuss the Photo Lab Cafe. Explain exactly what a Photo Lab Cafe is. And is there food involved?
Photo Cafe. We would sometimes have some wine and maybe like a bag of chips or something. As a photographer, it was really important to challenge the system. So I came together, Meg and Mac came up with the idea and I came on board and we developed this concept that was a collective to challenge the who's getting paid, how much are we getting paid? Like the power dynamic in a lot of industries is doesn't give the laborer often a lot of power. And so we wanted to, you know, everyone's doing photography for free and
you
a lot of people were being hired.
But you taught me better than that.
Yeah. And I have to say, Megan has been one of the most huge advocator for like, no, you should have more, like ask for more. Cause we're when you love what you do, I think, and you really are thankful for the job, for any kind of income, it's really hard to kind of put your foot down and say, no, I'm not going to take this job because you're not paying me how much it's worth. You know, with a lot of freelancing work, there's a lot that goes into it that people don't realize. Like you have to actually pay your own insurance. You have to pay your equipment. There's no, you know, the transportation. You're not doing an 8-hour shift. You're doing this chunk of work here and there. So it's a very different system from a salary job. So Photo Cafe was a way to bring in different speakers on different issues like representation and visibility or analog or education, and really to have these conversations about like, what is missing? What's great about it? What can we change?
So let's discuss Seeing Collective. It states that you are a co-founded Seeing Collective. So what is that about?
Yeah, well, that's what I was just talking about with Megan Mack. She'd come up with the concept. And often I think people see each other as competitors, and it was important for us to create this space where we were actually sharing our prices, right? You just mentioned before, like you and I had talked about, I told you like how much I get paid. I think it's really important to be transparent about these things rather than we keep our cards close and we think, you know, if I'm going to tell you, then you're going to outprice me. Or, I mean, why are we so competitive with one another instead of lifting each other up? That was what we wanted to do. And there's this great group of people. It's a pretty small collective. And we put on shows that people can actually get their work seen in it. You know, I mean, we thought it was really important to make these opportunities and the information much more accessible to people.
And I agree with you. There's enough food out there for all of us to eat. So I lift you, you lift me, we both rise. Mm-hmm. That's the way I look at it. How did you come up with that name?
Well, of course, as photography, it's seeing. So we wanted to kind of see not only through the camera, but we see the greater. We see everything around us. We also liked shortening it. We often say CC. So it's kind of fun in that way.
All right. So let's discuss your award-winning art-based teaching business. That sounds really exciting.
Well, that was when I was living in Berlin, and my friend Patricia Fowaczny.
Oh, say that again. Say that one more time.
She's Polish, okay. Polish-German, and I love creating things in partnership with people. I've really had the fortune of working with some extraordinary people. So Patty is now a teacher in Berlin, teaching art history. And so both of us have this interest in art and teaching. And so we decided that it was really important to give this space for young people to really explore artistic ideas. And the concept was that young people are often very, you know, we tell people they're either good at this or not. And the exploration of childhood art making is really important to foster. You, even if you go into math, this art practice can really help you to explore different ideas, to problem solve. And, you know, we would make like a hand puppet. We would make like piggy banks out of plastic bottles, and we would work on filmmaking and we dissect these films. And so it was learning English through play and artistic means.
Would you attribute growing up overseas where you grew up, Switzerland, and you said Berlin, did that attribute to, you know, your love of art? And that's where, you know, you kind of got the bug or the itch for all of that?
Well, I was only very young. So I was 2 years old when we moved from Germany to Oneonta. So I'm pretty much always been in upstate New York. And then I moved back to Berlin, or back to Southern Germany. After 18, it was like back and forth, Germany, US, back, Germany, US. So I would attribute my love of art to both of my parents, who are such creative individuals who love to think critically about art, who take us often to art shows. We have critical conversations about who is in power of art, what you can make art out of. The discarded materials, the refashioned garbage, is definitely inspired by my mom, who, you know, could make the most creative thing out of, you know, a heap of garbage.
Okay, well, Sina Basila Hickey, continue to let your light shine, all right? And we appreciate you. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy, H. Bosch Jr., your overcoming adversity specialist, doing what I'm made to believe.
That was H. Bosch Jr. interviewing me for the weekly segment of Triple E's. And I just wanted to add in there, I mentioned that freelancers don't work an 8-hour shift, but I do want to clarify that we usually work probably like 12 hours a day. And it's just that we may be doing a photography job and editing it at home and then doing research of how to do that work better. So I do want to make sure that people don't misunderstand that freelancing is working less, because it's usually working more.
HMM correspondent Steve Pierce speaks with Rebecca Watts, Regional Vice President of Western Governors University, about online education for working people.
We have on the phone Rebecca Watts of the Western Governors University. Welcome, Rebecca. Can you tell us a bit about the university?
Sure. Western Governors University is a nonprofit accredited university that uses a competency-based approach to prepare adult learners for in-demand careers. We deliver our programs through online technologies because it is an asynchronous, individually student-supported, student-paced program.
So I'm going to guess that you were doing that before COVID.
We started doing this in 1997. So yes, we were doing this before COVID hit the world.
And is this a state-funded program, or is it a private nonprofit or a for-profit?
It's private nonprofit. So we are not a public institution. Although we were founded by a group of governors, we do not receive public funds. Our students are eligible for Pell Grants. So our students are eligible for public funds because we're accredited, but we do not receive public funds.
So why would it have been formed by governors, but not as a public entity?
The governors that founded WGU created it out of an abundance of concern that the existing university and college systems in their states, many states, 19 states, were not providing sufficient opportunity for adult learners who worked full time, but still needed to access additional learning, degree programs, ongoing gaining of competency, skills, and knowledge to advance in their career pathways in and around the busy schedules of their lives. So they created it to be something that would fit into the spaces of people's lives and still be able to advance their careers without having to walk away from their current employment.
So that must have been a radical idea back in
1997. Yeah, it was a radical idea. And when they looked at what was needed, they looked at the model and the barriers to access being time and space and cost. They knew that what they had to come up with was really a truly innovative model that leveraged technology, but that also really focused very much on the one-on-one student support.
Now, how did this? How does this differ from the other models we may be familiar with? The for-profit schools, like I guess most famously Trump, but other ones, and then the not-for-profit schools that like yours, and the schools that are free, the online education that's free, and then Empire State College and things like that. How do you fit into the universe of these kinds of online entities?
So as you referenced, we are accredited, we are nonprofit. So in some ways we are already different than some of the institutions that you referenced, but alongside other accredited institutions, even alongside other nonprofit institutions, our model is completely different in that we don't have a lockstep approach to learning. So each student moves through at her or his own pace as soon as they can demonstrate the competencies that are required for the program. It's a competency-based program. Do you have the ability to demonstrate that you can do or know a thing? And those competencies are developed in collaboration with industry, with employers. They tell us what they need in the 21st century, in 2021 and forward, for their new employees or their existing employees to know and to be able to do. The other real innovation that we have is the one-on-one student support and the fact that we don't have a traditional academic calendar. New students start at the first of every month for six-month terms. We operate 12 months a year. We don't have summer breaks. We don't have traditional semesters. We operate just like business does, 12 months a year. And students move through their six-month term and then start their next six-month term in whatever month they complete that prior term. And they graduate in whatever month they complete their work. So they're not in lockstep. We measure learning, not time.
And how do you measure learning? Typically, we're in a test-based environment. Increasingly, are there tests to measure that, or how do you do it?
Absolutely. We have assessments that are tied to demonstration of the learning that's required for each program. And so an assessment, it depends on what the competency is, but an assessment can be an objective assessment that's delivered online in a proctored setting. So the live proctor is assuring that the student is the person that's demonstrating the skills and knowledge. And that assessment is evaluated on a common rubric across the university. We have a unique faculty model. So we have faculty mentors, graduate prepared in the discipline, that serve one-on-one support for each student. Then we have a faculty role that are the course instructors that teach each course. And then importantly, to your question, we have a faculty role that serve solely as evaluators. So we have no grading bias. The evaluators grade the work of students, not the course instructors and not the mentors. So evaluators are looking at work of students that they have never met. So it's clearly objective and clearly without bias.
And is it like a typical university where you have all different kinds of academic programs or liberal arts and, you know, all kinds of different things? Or is it focused? You've talked a lot about the connections with business. Is it mostly a business education environment?
Great question. We have four colleges and over 60 programs. Within our four colleges, College of Business, College of Information Technology, College of Health Professions, and Teachers College. So from nursing to medical coding to health information management, cybersecurity, accounting, management, teaching, building principles, educational leadership programs. So we have a full array of programs that we offer because they have been shown to be in demand, meaning that the demand for talent in those areas is greater than the current supply. We do not have what you would consider liberal arts programs. So we don't have poli-sci, we don't have psych, we don't have soc. We have programs that are directly aligned to career pathways.
We have on the phone Rebecca Watts, who's the regional vice president of Western Governors University, talking about the online education there. It sounds like it's a big place. You have, you said there's many states, 19 states that are involved in the consortium?
Well, there are governors from 19 states that founded the university, but we really serve all 50 states. So in the Northeast region, I'm responsible for how we are fulfilling our mission in 12 states and the District of Columbia. So we are in every state and actually the US territories as well.
And how many students do you have?
We right now have about 130,000 students. Again, that number changes every month. It grows every month. But remember, students are graduating every month as well. So right at 130,000 students.
And how many of those are in New York State?
250 students in the Capital Region and more than 2,900 students in the state of New York.
And how do these students find out about you?
In many instances, they learn about us by searching for online degree programs. In other instances, they learn about us through our partnerships that we have with employers. So we have a team of people in the Northeast region that work with employers, community colleges, school districts to make sure that those entities are aware of the opportunities that we offer for their employees, or in terms of community colleges for their graduates. Many of our students come to us after completing an associate degree at a community college.
And is there a demographic profile that fits most of the students?
Our average age is 33. That has come down over the last few years. More than 70% of our students are working adults. Also, more than 70% of our students are in what would be characterized as a historically underrepresented population. So they have characteristics that have historically been underrepresented in higher ed. People in poverty, people of color, people in rural communities. And we also have a significant percentage of our students from military populations, military veterans and dependents.
And why would students come to you rather than to one of the many other options that are out there, the free online education or in New York State, the state-funded online education or a for-profit school? Why would they come to you?
In many instances, our tuition rate is a real point of differentiation for people. Our tuition for a six-month term is $3,500 for undergraduate programs, and that includes all your learning materials, so no book fees on top of that. So all in for 12 months of learning, stacking 2 6-month terms together, you're right at $7,000. So it is a low-cost, high-quality, accredited option that employers respect. When we ask employers how our graduates do and if they would continue to hire our graduates, more than 95% of them say absolutely yes. So we have the proof is in the outcomes of our students. And when people are looking for an assurance of an investment in higher education and what that will lead to in terms of continued success in your career pathway, that we have the evidence to show that our students do find that success. And so that's a big point of differentiation for us. That is not to say that there are not other great universities out there, that the public university system in the state of New York is not doing a great job. In fact, SUNY does a great job. CUNY does a great job. The public and private institutions in the state of New York do fabulous work in supporting learning for people. We do not exist to supplant the great work of other universities. We exist to supplement that work and to reach those that are currently not being served by the existing models.
Sounds fantastic. How can people find out more about it?
Go to wgu.edu and just explore. You can see our degree programs there. You can see scholarship opportunities there that we offer. Some of the scholarship opportunities are specific to degree programs, nursing, business, cybersecurity, but other scholarship programs that we have relate to specific needs. For example, we have access scholarships right now for people that do not have what they need to get to online learning. In other words, they are victims of the digital divide.
Well, thank you very much, Rebecca. It's great to hear more about Western Governors University, and we hope to hear more from you in the future.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was HMM correspondent Steve Pierce speaking with Rebecca Watts, Regional Vice President of Western Governors University.
And Sada Stanley is a member of Pathways to Peace Committee of Albany Women Against War. She discusses the efforts opposing the militarization of police with Mark Dunley of the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're joined by a member of Women Against War on the committee called Pathways to Peace. Anita Stanley, mother of three and a grandmother of seven. She is part of, or at least helps head up the Young Peacemakers Week. But, you know, right now, I understand that you have a project that's focused on the issue of demilitarization of the police on all levels. So how does the peace group address the demilitarization of the police?
That's right, because usually we're into more global issues. So that's a good question. We're addressing demilitarization of the police because of a provision in the National Defense Authorization Act called the 1033 program, where surplus military grade equipment is transferred from the armed services to local police departments and also county municipalities. The purpose is to address drug trafficking and terrorism. But of course, once that equipment, the rifles, the armored vehicles, the mine-resistant vehicles. Once they get into the hands of the police, they're used for a variety of purposes and not just those two. And there is a stipulation for most of those departments that equipment be used within the first year that it's received, which generates a lot of activity and not so good use within that first year just because of the mandate. And the reason why it's coming around now to Pathways to Peace in terms of addressing that issue is because of Governor Cuomo's mandate to reform and reinvent the police. That means that each city or county has the mandate, if they want funding, to change their policing to be more in sync with Black Lives Matter, with peaceful use of policing. And so the two have combined to make it an issue that we want to address.
Now, I remember watching, I think it was last summer, what I'll call a Black Lives Matter protest, perhaps a spinoff, occurring in the south end of Albany one evening. And the Albany police rolled out a pretty big looking vehicle, looked like some type of military vehicle. Is that one example of the type of militarization going on?
Yes, that's exactly right. And the Albany police get thousands and thousands of dollars worth of equipment. So does the Albany County Sheriff's Department. And in fact, I think in Rensselaer County, the Sheriff's Department got $644,734.26 worth of equipment. That includes rifles, illuminators. It's quite a haul.
Well, some of us say, well, you know, being in Rensselaer County, we need the sheriff to protect us from militia coming over from Vermont, as was the case, I guess, four people arrested at the 11,000 Black Lives Matter protest in Troy this summer. But so why should people be concerned about the issue of the militarization of the police?
Sure. Well, the first reason is it's been a total failure. That Authorization Act that I mentioned earlier started in 1997, and there has been a lot of research data collected in the years since then. And it has failed to increase public safety and has actually resulted in an escalation of excessive force and increases the risk that force will be used. Police departments that get more equipment from the military kill more civilians than departments that get less military gear. So right there, we have a very clear indicator. The Albany report, which was just completed, the collaborative to reform their police department, I'm quoting here, said police departments use the command structure of the military, and many see themselves as warriors on the front lines in an armed conflict, and view members of the community as the enemy who must be controlled or imprisoned and divided into good people and bad guys, which of course sets them one against each other. So once that mindset is there, you're bound to have more violence than otherwise.
Now, my suspicion is the militarization of the police did not occur under President Trump, but was probably going on before the orange one took office. You know, when did this escalation of the militarization of police occur at the federal level? What was the...
Yeah, it started in 1997. So we have a good almost 25 years under our belt of growth in this department on both counties.
So what is your group or others recommending to address the issue of militarization of the police?
Well, the ACLU, Amnesty International, and a number of other national organizations wrote a wonderful letter to President Biden with four recommendations in it. One, that we have civilian review boards of the policing agencies with subpoena power. And actually, this was just brought up by Mayor Madden in the Troy meeting that we had on Monday night. where we need not just the review board, which in many cases are already in place, but we need ones that have teeth that can really make a difference. Also, some people don't want to do away with the whole surplus equipment 1033 program. They just want to do away with the parts of it that give out military grade equipment, because there are things like file cabinets, desks, waste baskets, things like that, that don't have anything to do with a military effort. So if we could separate those two, that letter to President Biden recommended that, so we could still get the other surplus equipment. We need data on those items, which is being done, and we need to continue with that. And we need to recall the military equipment that's already in place nationwide in these police departments.
So when you raise this with the city of Troy, and presumably you've done it with other local governments, what has been the response of the local elected officials?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because there's quite the difference, or has been up till this week, between Albany and Troy. Albany, the committee that's addressing the reinvention issue, was very representative of all kinds of minorities, not only women, people of color, Black and brown people, also LGBTQ, a very rainbow, diverse group. Whereas Troy only had two members of color in the whole committee, and that was reflected in the fact that their response was, up until this week, really quite defensive and not at all productive in terms of coming up with good ideas. But this Monday, that all changed, where Chris Burke, who is the director of Unity House, spoke up about how racism is really the central issue in all of these. In fact, militarization, the reason that it's of a concern is that it increases racial tensions disproportionately with people of color. So he gave a wonderful presentation, which actually seemed to change the minds of the city officials that were there into a much more positive framework about addressing these issues.
So we've been talking to Anita Stanley, Women Against War, a committee called Pathways to Peace. So if people want to be effective at the grassroots level and connect also with your group, how best can they do that in 30 seconds?
Sure. Both the national level and the state level have bills right before the legislature and the Congress right now. Write your congressperson, tell you that you support the demilitarization of police. And if you want to contact somebody with written comments, write to the Rensselaer County Police Reform and Reinvention Collaborative. And for Women Against War, to join our own group, you can call me at Anita Stanley, 518-441-7722. Or you can go on the Women Against War Facebook site or our regular website.
Thank you very much, Anita. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Thank you, Mark Dunley. And Anita Stanley just gave us some information on how we can get involved if we want to support the demilitarization of the police.
That concludes our show for tonight. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Kaylin.
And I'm Sina Bazila Hickey, who is also your engineer. Well, remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. And you can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, questions, or to comment on our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. Thank you. If you are interested in helping with our radio efforts, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending an email requesting an invitation link to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in. Stay safe.